I've always been someone that's very vocal and tries to express how I feel at all times. But depression is something that you can't explain, and that's what's so frustrating to get across to people that just really don't understand.
This is Contributing Factors, produced by Health Further. I'm Caroline Leland, here to share with you the third episode in our series on how depression is understood, experienced, and treated throughout our health system. To tell this story, we're focusing on one single patient and how her experience represents and how it doesn't represent the systems we all live and participate in. Today, we're honing in on the social context of depression. We'll explore this through the perspectives of an individual with depression along with her family members, plus a medical sociologist, a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner, and a federally funded social worker. We're starting here in Chapter 8, Friends and Family. As you know from listening to the first two episodes, we're packing a lot into this series. If you're interested in a particular aspect of the discussion and want to hear more, you can find bonus material, including full interviews with the experts you're about to hear from, at healthfurther.com/contributing-factors on the page for episode 3. Please remember that nothing in this episode can or should be taken as medical advice. Every situation is unique. If you need help, please seek it out from a professional or find a trusted friend to help you do that. Your doctor and care team can give you qualified advice and treatment that can make a real difference. Okay, here's that patient voice again, telling us more about how depression affects her friendships.
I've always felt that I had to be happy in front of to keep friends, like constantly pretend that I'm happy, because no one wants to be around a depressed person, right? No one wants to deal with it. It's a lot for people to deal with. So I felt like a burden always. And even now with my closest friends who have never suffered from depression, it's still an issue because they don't understand the way that I think.
Lucera Cifuentes, whose voice you're hearing, has a plethora of stories illustrating this tension. When you're depressed, how can you be a good friend to others without totally faking how you're feeling? How can you explain to someone, even someone who cares about you deeply, that your brain chemistry simply doesn't enable you to feel happiness? There are no simple answers to these questions. For a large period of time during high school and college, Cifuentes dealt with her depression by trying to hide it from her friends.
I think I overcompensated like my extreme depression in public by being extremely social and happy to the point that I was just as an act, and I felt like I was a clown every day putting on an act.
That act was pretty convincing.
I was studying psychology at that point, and I remember I was in abnormal psychology, and two of my friends were asking me about the class, like, oh, how's the class? And I was telling them, oh, I love it, but I'm becoming a hypochondriac because I think I have everything. And I remember one of them said, well, one thing you definitely don't have is depression. You're the happiest person I've ever met. And I remember just kind of laughing. And then I kept thinking about it later. I was like, wow, like I have everyone fooled somehow. How do they think I'm okay?
Cifuentes covered her depression with a mask of happiness, a false show of humor and positivity, and her friends were fooled for the most part. It took years before Cifuentes gained the confidence to be open about her depression in the way she described at the beginning of this episode. That shift can be traced back to a single incident during a birthday group outing that finally convinced Cifuentes to start going to therapy in college.
I remember it was my two friends were celebrating their birthday, and I kind of had to go out with them. And it was just to dinner and stuff, but there's like a bus that we used to take the P2P, and we took it to a restaurant. And I remember just looking at my reflection in the window of the bus and like just wanting to punch the reflection and just feeling disgusted. And I had like a breakdown at the party, and I felt really guilty because I felt that I ruined it, but I really couldn't help it. Like I was trying really hard to be normal for them for that day, and I just couldn't.
That was the wake-up call. It was time to pursue therapy. And so she did for several years. And therapy helped a lot. It was what helped her realize she has not only depression, but also body dysmorphic disorder, a terrible disease that distorts how she sees herself in the mirror. So therapy is clearly a good thing, certainly in this case. But even now, Cifuentes gets frustrated because she feels like friends sometimes recommend therapy as an easy out for her, an excuse to keep them from having to share any of her emotional burdens.
My friends didn't know what to do, so they kept being just like, you need a therapist, you need a therapist, you need a therapist. And in a way that made me angry, and that I felt like sometimes people don't try to understand you, and instead they just say, go to a therapist. Like, oh, I don't really care how you're feeling. Just go to a therapist and talk about it, because I don't really care. I know that's not what they meant, because I know they actually care about me, but that is something, like, sometimes, like, depression, mental illness isn't something that only therapists should know about. I think it's something that everyone should understand in a way.
Those friends were almost certainly trying to help Cifuentes, to encourage her to do what was best for her. But the thing about depression is that it makes you irrational. The way you see the world is totally clouded by your depression, your negativity, your self-loathing. If you've seen the animated movie Inside Out, I particularly liked the depiction of depression as a little blue character in the girl's head. This little blue character had the opposite of the Midas touch, so instead of everything he touched turning to gold, it all turned blue. And this little blue guy was touching this girl's memories, so that even the happy memories turned blue and sad. That struck me as so spot on, that depression ruins things that should be happy, that otherwise would obviously and unquestionably be happy. If Cifuentes' friends were telling her to seek therapy because they cared about her and were worried about her depression, it was almost impossible for her to see that, because the depression itself made her intensely pessimistic, automatically jumping to the worst possible conclusion. That's what depression does. It warps your worldview and poisons your interactions with other people. Depression made it hard for Cifuentes to be a good friend, to appreciate her friends, and to enjoy time spent with her friends. But depression impacted her personal relationships even more intensely at home.
I hated myself so much that it maybe projected, and I wasn't always most wonderful presence, which I think annoyed my family, and that my family dealt with hardships, physical hardships, and, you know, immigrating to the U.S., like, their stories are so much more difficult on the surface if you listen to it versus mine, which I had, like, the cushioned little life that they made the sacrifices for me to have. So to them, I think it seems like she has no reason to be like this. She's ungrateful. But I know I've never been ungrateful. I'm extremely appreciative, and I think I'm more appreciative every day for my family and everything, but it was just something that I couldn't control.
Cifuentes says her family's Mexican cultural background made it even harder for them to talk openly about mental health.
I don't know how many family get-togethers I ran out of crying. And a lot of times it was just like, she's a traumatic, she's such a brat, she's so hateful. Like, how poor Rosie, my mom, like, how does she deal with her?
Cifuentes' younger brother, Oscar, explains his and his family's struggle to understand.
I always looked up to her, but we're from a Mexican family, so mental health was never really a priority. So I knew she was always down. She was always feeling something that I couldn't understand. I just assumed she was a moody teenager, like every other teenager. But as she started getting older, I guess I started learning more, and I started realizing that it wasn't just growing up. It was something in her brain that was different.
Oscar Cifuentes, who is 20 years old, now studies psychology at Brevard College in Brevard, North Carolina, which is where the siblings grew up. He says his sister's mental health journey is part of why he's interested to learn more about the field.
I wanted to be there for her, but like I said, I just didn't understand. I still don't, even studying it, there's just so much we don't know. Our parents and our aunts, uncles, cousins, they don't really understand it either. Well, I'm sure some of them do, because they also deal with the same things, but other than those few, they also just viewed her as someone being very problematic, unnecessarily so.
Cifuentes' mother, Rosa, says that like Oscar, it took her many years of frustration and anguish before she even began to understand her daughter's disease.
Well, at first, I wasn't sure what it was. I just thought it was just being a normal moody teenager. So, you know, everybody kept telling me, oh, she'll grow out of it. You know, teenager's very moody, and I would get really mad at her because I figured she was just being, you know, doing it for attention. I never really thought that it would be, you know, depression, or at least as bad as she had it.
Lucero Cifuentes' depression made her impossible to get along with or to have fun with at home.
She was always angry. She was always mad. I couldn't talk to her. It made things hard for everyone in the family. Just caused issues between all of us because, you know, I wanted to do family fun things, but she never wanted to. She was just constantly in a bad mood. I wasn't sure what to do with her. I mean, I just thought, oh, she'll outgrow this as soon as she gets older. This is just a phase.
Rosa Cifuentes speaks of her memories of her daughter's childhood with wistfulness and regret.
All I wanted for her was to be happy, and it was really hard for her to be happy. And there was times that I would get so mad at her because it wasn't that I was really mad at her. I was just mad at the whole situation, and I would get so frustrated with her because she's just wanted to shake her and say, can't you just be happy? Can't you just be normal? Like all the other kids that are out, you know, out with their friends at the mall, having fun, not at home crying or sulking and feeling like you're the ugliest or the fattest or just the worst person in the world. And I guess I would, you know, compare her to other teenagers, and I just wanted her to be normal. I felt like she wasn't normal. As it was just hard. It's still hard.
The effects of Lucero Cifuentes' struggle kept radiating outward in a painful example of how the consequences of depression or any serious health issue can cascade into family and other social structures. Because Lucero Cifuentes was the firstborn in her family and because her brother was 4 years younger, their mother didn't have any points of reference for what was normal for a teenager in the U.S. Lucero Cifuentes' angry outbursts eventually convinced Rosa Cifuentes that she was the one to blame for her daughter's unhappiness, especially because Rosa Cifuentes had experienced depression while pregnant with Lucero Cifuentes.
There was a point where I felt like I had done was all my fault because I made her the way she was. I had been a bad mother. I made her feel that way. Sometimes I would wish I could go back and start from the beginning as a baby and maybe be more positive towards her, maybe not. I don't know. I thought that I could change things if I could just go back and change things, but I mean, I know that it's not something that you can't help it. Even, you know, even if you go back in time, it was in her, a chemical imbalance in her brain.
Rosa Cifuentes felt a sense of relief when learning her daughter's diagnosis. It helped alleviate some of her own guilt. Even so, Lucero Cifuentes feels that her whole family still doesn't fully understand the disease. And maybe they never will. After all, for a healthy person, depression is nearly incomprehensible. How could you understand it if you've never experienced anything like it? Or if you're raised to think that you're fully responsible for your own emotional experience no matter what?
And it wasn't until I was older that I realized that there was such depression in my family, that it is genetic. And my father also struggles with depression, but I know he will never admit it. He was always very much like, it's all in your head, things like that, which he didn't realize how detrimental that was for me. For him to say that it was all in my control and the way I was viewing things and that I was weak in the way that I was thinking. And I know he never meant harm. I know he loves me so much, but it did affect me a lot.
Unlike her father, Lucero Cifuentes' mother does realize that depression is a disease with a physiological basis. Even so, Rosa Cifuentes says that she does relate to some of her husband's frustrations.
My husband didn't believe in that depression existed. He said it was up to a person to be happy or not. So he would tell her, it's in your head, you have to be positive, you have to be happy, you're the one that's making yourself miserable. And of course that would upset her more because she couldn't help herself. She couldn't help feeling that way. And I guess that sometimes I would get so aggravated that I would feel the same way. I would tell her, can't you just try to be happier, can't you? And she would get upset. She said, you don't understand. I can't just change. I can't just be happy when you want me to be or be positive and everything will turn out perfect. And my husband would tell her, you know, it's in your head. You can make it. You can be happy if you really try. So that was really hard for her. Hearing that, it upset her more because I guess she felt like she was failing us because we were failing her by making her, you know, telling her these things. Like, you have to be happy. You've got to make yourself happy.
Even now, 10 years after Cifuentes started taking antidepressants, cultural barriers still keep her family from understanding how she experiences life. But Lucero Cifuentes says that nonetheless, their support has been crucial for her stability.
I was literally probably the worst teenager of all time. And I was mean, and I said such mean things to my mom, like, I hate you, you're the worst. I wish I had a different family. And those things are really hurtful to a parent, but I regretted it as soon as I said it. I knew I didn't mean it, but my hatred for myself and my inability to control my emotions would just cause these huge meltdowns where I was just screaming at the people that I loved the most because I couldn't do that in public, obviously. But now that I'm older and I'm better and that my mood is more stable and I've had more experience expressing how I feel, I'm able to look back and explain to them, this is why I was that way. And they've also grown, I think, in a way that they understand it more. And I think maybe my aunts, who now my cousins or their children are older and maybe going through things of their own, they understand in a different way. So now I think I'm closer to my family now. And they're everything because they stuck by me. My family, even if they don't completely understand, I think they try.
Today, Lucero Cifuentes depends just as heavily on her family for emotional support, especially since she's now living in a new country.
Like, I find myself texting my mom, I'm really sad today, I don't know what to do. And I feel guilty because I'm putting it on her, and she's the person who's most affected by it. Like, if I'm hurting, she's hurting.
Though Rosa Cifuentes understands more now, she still struggles with how to best be there for her daughter.
I didn't know how to deal with it. And I still sometimes don't. I think nobody really knows exactly how to deal with it at all the time. Because it's not like you can go take, you know, if you're sick, you can just take something for your stomach and you're better. It's not something like that. It's not that easy.
A 2005 American Journal of Psychiatry study found that only half of families with a depressed member perceived their own family functioning as healthy. Meanwhile, clinicians rated 70%, that's more than two-thirds, of those same families as unhealthy. This is because chronic depressive illness can be contagious. Family members and coworkers can become depressed because of the intense stress of living and working with a depressed person. Think about the symptoms of chronic depression. Anhedonia, which means the inability to feel pleasure. Insomnia, the inability to sleep. Irritability, we all know how frustrating that is in close context. Imagine living with someone who can't experience any kind of pleasure, even in things they used to find fun. They can't sleep, they're extremely irritable, they're also probably taking steps to isolate themselves even beyond these other problems. For those reasons, it's immensely relieving when depression is demystified. When a doctor or other professional shows a family how the disease works and explains why the patient acts the way they do, then the family feels guilt lifted. Anger fades. It becomes easier, though not quite easy, to cope with the daily difficulties of chronic depression. The Cifuentes family experienced this pattern of frustration and relief. Not understanding the disease drove them all crazy. They couldn't grasp why Lucero Cifuentes was so negative and sad all the time. They wondered what they were doing wrong. Learning about depression and how it works helped and still helps them cope with these overwhelming challenges. That power of knowledge helps Lucero Cifuentes with her friends, too.
I'll bring it up in casual conversation, my depression, and people are kind of surprised by that, but I think it's the only way to to normalize and to get people to understand. And so when I do feel upset, like sometimes I'll tell my friends like, oh, don't think it's nothing you do. Like, I'm feeling depressed today. So, and they're like, oh, okay. So they get it. And they know that it's not personal if like I'm not laughing at their jokes or they're not constantly like, what's wrong? What's wrong? Because that is a trigger for me. Like always someone be always asking me what's wrong. And it's like, I don't know. So at this point, you know, usually people I'm around know. They don't know. And my friends still say, I will never understand how you actually feel. But they're learning to understand it better and have less judgmental about how I'm acting in the moment. And realize that it's not me being childish or anything like that. It's me just literally not being able to control the overwhelming, like, nothingness or sadness that I feel on a day-to-day basis.
Chapter 9, A Model That Mirrors a Messy Reality. So we've seen that depression hugely impacts a patient's relationships with their family and with their friends, with every relationship in their life, really. But what's the broader significance of all this? These things are important for more than compassion's sake. It's crucial for our society to understand these patterns because that is the only way for us to figure out how to treat depression effectively when it does happen. Medical sociologist Bernice Pesco-Solido, who is a distinguished professor at Indiana University, designed a healthcare utilization model called the Network Episode Model. This model explains how sick people get to medical care based on their social context. Specifically, the model addresses how social networks connect individuals to their communities and to the institutional structures around them. And this is not so much virtual social networks, but real ones, who you interact with as you go about your day. Pesco-Solido's model explains how those social networks influence the way individuals come to recognize health problems, how they respond to the onset of those problems, and how they go about finding and using healthcare services. Studying all this helps us understand sociological elements that drive healthcare outcomes. For example, social networks often determine whether a patient adheres to a prescribed treatment. Your partner or a close friend might be the person who incentivizes you to keep taking your pills. Pesco-Solido says that when she was working on her PhD at Yale, she noticed the existing models at the time didn't explain what she was actually seeing happen in terms of how individual people came to engage with the healthcare system. Pesco-Solido was in graduate school at a time when healthcare utilization studies, that is, studying how people get to care, were just becoming the norm.
I was really excited by those because this was a time in social science. People were really doing these large utilization surveys of the nation for the first time. They had really developed survey research to a sophisticated level.
At the time, and this was in the 90s, there were three main models in use for explaining how people made healthcare decisions from this sociology point of view.
But the more I studied them, the more I realized two things. The first was that I didn't know anybody who made their healthcare decisions the way that these theories proposed. And the second was that they were so clean and neat and so regimented that it didn't really at all fit the situation I was most interested in, which was mental health. The assumption underlying these, like the image of the decision maker underlying these models, was this very rational person who had pretty good knowledge and awareness, self-awareness, community awareness, and weighed the costs and benefits of the whole list of contingencies that they had described in each one of these theories.
Pesco-Solido was dissatisfied with how unrealistic this seemed.
So I started to think about how do people in the real world make their decisions. And I got a bit obsessed with this. So everybody I met, I would ask them, now last time that you felt like you needed care, what did you do? At this point, I was maybe in my late mid-20s, and still what I always did was call my mother and say, Ma, I have this, you know, and she would say, well, you need to do this, that, or the other, or you need to go to the doctor. And so it struck me that in the community, people look for a person that they can depend on, either because they have a history of caregiving or they're tied somehow to medical knowledge or medical services, and they provide you with a guide of things that you can do. So I started thinking about healthcare decision making as very peopled, that it wasn't in your head, that it was about the people who surrounded you, who gave you advice or pushed you into care or guilted you into going or made you go because you couldn't participate in sports or take that job unless you had a physical. And so I tried to develop a model that struck me as much more messy and complex, but much more realistic in how people got to care.
One thing in particular that motivated Pesco-Solito to develop this new model was that those utilization studies that were being done at the time showed that a tremendous number of people never got to care, even if they recognized that they had a health problem. Pesco-Solito wanted to address that gap to figure out what was causing it, because it wasn't being explained by the rationality-based behavior models that existed at the time.
That's really how I got into it. It just didn't fit the reality that I understood. And it fit a nice, clean, ivory tower hope of how people would make their healthcare decisions. But there's a big difference between the sort of ideotypical models that academics come up with and the real world, which is kind of messy.
Pesco-Solito's model didn't take the world by storm because it totally challenges the pre-existing models of thinking about how an individual makes health decisions. But it did introduce a new and more realistic way to think about things.
Depending upon your goal for research, it becomes a very useful tool, or it becomes too difficult to do.
Pesco-Solito says her model resonates with people who have illness.
It didn't make sense to economists, though, I have to tell you that.
Economists assume that people are rational actors, of course, but
people aren't rational about their health. If they were, then we'd have nobody who smoked, nobody who drank, nobody who eats French fries.
Because of the network episode model, Pesco-Solito herself has had to adjust how she approaches her work.
I now have to think about new ways to design studies, new ways to convince people to fund the studies, new ways to analyze the data, and I'm still struggling with some of that stuff.
In particular, the network episode model defies traditional statistical approaches. It assumes that no individual makes a decision in a vacuum of rationality. Whether we want to admit it or not, our decisions are heavily influenced by the people in our lives. This complicates the scientific study of behavioral health decisions, but Pesco-Solito believes we should not shy away from complexity just because it's less convenient.
One of my mentors was Eleanor Ostrom, who won the Nobel Prize for economics. She said, you know, our goal now in this next phase of science is not to try to simplify or eliminate complexity, but to embrace it. And I am totally of that persuasion.
So what benefit does Pesco-Solito's model offer our society? How do we know it's not just unnecessarily complicating things? Complex models like the network episode model are important for our healthcare leaders to be able to design systems that effectively protect mental health.
Getting people efficiently to a doctor and appropriately to a doctor strikes me as requiring this kind of understanding of what's going through people's heads and in their communities and in the people they talk to.
If we don't understand how that behavioral process works, we can't design programs to help people identify their own mental health issues and then to take the appropriate steps to be healthy. Going back to Lucero Cifuentes, this concept is directly relevant to her patient experience. Maybe she would have gone to therapy sooner if a trusted personal advisor had told her to. Certainly, her family would have experienced less anguish if someone in their community had been able to identify the issues she was facing. But of course, that would have required the family to talk about those issues outside of the home, which they felt was inappropriate at the time. Thinking about that situation, it becomes obvious how a person's social network determines their pathways to care. Pesco-Solito says her studies have shown that institutional support systems are key for an individual's mental health.
The best examples, I think, are being evangelical in the South is probably a good thing. Being evangelical in the Northeast, probably not so good. Being Jewish in New York is probably a good thing. Being Jewish in Alabama, probably not such a good thing, right? And we could test that, and we found that to be true. So it didn't work out. I mean, not everything works out 100%, but the data do suggest that there's something about the religion that you belong to and the number of co-religionists around you and whether or not they are the historical hubs of that religion that have built institutional support systems that matter.
Chapter 10, Unpacking Social Determinants and Dismantling Stigma. Vasconcelos' study was about religion, but it's not such a leap to apply that concept to other types of personal identity, like ethnicity. Cifuentes says her childhood environment, where she was in a cultural minority, was a key trigger for her depression and body dysmorphic disorder.
I had grown up in a very close-minded southern town in North Carolina, where I felt self-conscious just being who I was, because I was Hispanic and I felt like I wasn't accepted. And so I was more self-conscious about my appearance and my culture.
Cifuentes says childhood classmates made fun of the dark hair on her arms. They made her feel ugly and rejected because of her Latina heritage. It's hard not to imagine that a stronger Latino community in Cifuentes' hometown might have helped insulate her from some of the mental health issues she was experiencing from such an early age. Cifuentes moved to Madrid about a year ago at age 23 in order to escape that old feeling of cultural isolation.
I feel like I'm better here without a therapist than I am in the U.S. with a therapist. When I came to Spain, people were immediately like, "You're one of us."
Cifuentes says moving to Spain, despite her family's worries, was the best decision she's ever made.
I felt accepted immediately when I first came to Madrid, and I cried. I guess it wasn't happiness, but just knowing that I just didn't feel so shitty. Like I was okay with things, and I wanted to be where I was in that moment. And I don't think I'd ever had that feeling. It felt right. And I felt like I had finally found a place where I could be myself. And I still had issues with depression, but it was like normal, like normal enough that I could still live my daily life. I also started to look in the mirror and not be as disgusted with myself. So I started to see how the environment was changing me.
Cifuentes probably would have had an easier time all these years if her family and community had had more awareness and understanding of mental health generally, and of her specific mental health challenges of depression and body dysmorphic disorder. She probably would have had an easier time if her childhood peers had respected her heritage instead of mocking her non-whiteness. We could play the what-if game forever, but it seems clear from modern research that social support is crucial when it comes to mental health, from your family to your friends to your broader culture. And that support isn't just about making someone feel good about themselves. It's about getting people the treatment they need in order to be healthy, contributing members of society. People with depression in particular need extra support sticking with treatment. Accountability is important because depression takes away your motivation to do anything, let alone pick up your prescription every month or drive yourself to a therapist every week. Here's psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner Mary Carter, who works at the Renfrew Center in Nashville.
Trying to do any of these therapies alone is going to feel impossible on some level. And so if they have a partner who can help drive them to therapy or gently check in and make sure they're taking their medication without, you know, becoming a helicopter partner or encouraging them to get out and exercise, doing it with them, whatever it might be, that makes a huge difference as well.
Clinicians like Carter get to see patients once a month, twice a month at most. This limits how much they can enforce their own prescriptions.
And so it's got to be those people in the home or close friends or some kind of support system that's immediately accessible that can help motivate adherence to treatment as well.
Close family and friends can serve as a positive force in helping someone seek and stick to treatment. But depression complicates those relationships by damaging them through its emotionally detrimental nature. As we saw in Lucero Cifuentes' story, depression self-perpetuates by damaging those very interpersonal relationships that a depressed person needs to survive.
Because it's such a confusing disorder to confront if you're the loved one, if you're the intimate partner, if you're the child and your loved one is depressed, it's hard to know how to help them because they become so withdrawn. Isolation is another symptom of depression. They become so withdrawn that you see the quality of those relationships suffer. And that can be in part what passes down that trigger, so to speak, to that child or to even that partner, or where you might see that relationship dissolve because the depression is so profound that it really does change that person and it's hard to know them anymore. And so you can see how even just on a micro level, family systems are impacted by depression.
We saw a glimpse of how that played out in the Cifuentes family. Luckily, they managed to stick together and to get through the worst of it. And luckily, both the Cifuentes parents have decent jobs. Imagine that same relational family stress, but with the added stress of poverty, of exhaustion from working too many hours for too little pay, of wondering whether your electricity will get shut off because your paycheck was late, all on top of the emotional exhaustion caused by depression. North Carolina-based social worker Hannah Sanny sees a lot of low-income patients in her work.
My name is Hannah Sanny. I'm a licensed clinical social work associate, and I work with a federally qualified health center. That just means it's a primary care office that gets federal funding, so we see anybody and everybody regardless of ability to pay. But most of the time, that looks like anxiety and depression.
Sanny says income is a huge driver of mental health. Basically, poverty makes you more likely to have depression and less likely to be treated.
So most certainly, you have an increased reason to be depressed. If your lights are going out every 5 seconds and you're stressed, a lot of depression starts with stress. And if you have low socioeconomic ability or mobility, then you have way more reason to be stressed. The suffocating, chronic stress that is caused by not being able to pay your bills, having to work more than 40 hours a week just to not be able to pay your bills, having to, you know, miss out on a lot of your children's lives because you're working and not being able to take off work to actually take time to go to their class recital or whatever it might be. The antecedent of depression, they're way higher risk in terms of that.
High-income people with depression are more likely to have the social support they need to push them in the direction of care, as described by Pesco-Solito's network episode model of behavioral health decisions.
If you are depressed and you are kind of middle class or upper class, you likely have friends around you who are A, educated enough, or B, able to be aware of their surroundings because their life isn't so stressful that they're only consumed by what they're doing, to notice that and to come to you and say, hey, I can tell you're feeling really down. What can we do about that? I'd like to go with you to see your doctor, or how do we make you a doctor's appointment?
Of course, though, not everyone who grows up poor is depressed, and there are also depressed people who grow up in a highly privileged childhood. We want to be careful not to make generalizations here. Depression is also correlated with factors having nothing to do with income, like childhood trauma or queer identity. But it's indisputable that poverty is associated with more limited access to healthcare in any dimension.
Of course, there are plenty of people who have a lot of odds stacked up against them who come out, and they're like one of those people who could never, anything could happen and they would never be depressed. And that's kind of where that nature piece comes in. But again, the risk is higher the more stress you have that you will get depression, and the risk is higher that you will not have the same supports or even access to care. So without federally qualified health centers like the one I work in, if my organization wasn't in Gastonia, the health department would be the only place that people who couldn't afford to pay could go.
Gastonia, of course, is the town where Sanny works. It's just outside of Charlotte.
And the health department doesn't have primary care and most certainly doesn't have psychiatric care or behavioral health providers right there to see you. So if you live in a rural community where there might not even be a doctor in your town or something like that, help looks a lot different, and you're unlikely to have transportation to get to, you know, the town over, or friends that can keep your kids while you go to that appointment. You know, you can just imagine any kind of barriers. They just grow and grow and grow the more you struggle socially and economically.
Just a couple other examples in this vein. In addition to poverty, depression is also correlated with other life challenges like incarceration and drug and alcohol abuse. A third of people with substance abuse problems also have depression. I mentioned queer identities earlier. LGBTQ individuals are twice as likely to have a mental health condition. I also mentioned earlier that childhood trauma is another factor correlated with depression. According to the World Health Organization, when people experience trauma at an early age, it can cause long-term changes in how their brains respond to fear and stress. People who have a history of sleep disturbances, medical illnesses, chronic pain, anxiety, and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder are all more likely to develop depression. None of these are necessarily causes of depression, they're simply correlations, which means they're linked somehow, but we're still not exactly sure what causes what when it comes to mental health. but it's important to recognize those correlations as risk factors. Austin, Texas-based clinical social worker Rachel Massell is continually surprised by the pervasiveness of depression across all kinds of categories.
Gender, sexual orientation, age, race, ethnicity, depression doesn't discriminate. At the same time, we do know that women experience depression more in their lifetime than, or more likely to experience it more in their lifetime than men. And then, of course, there's the intergenerational trauma of in communities of people of color and then persecuted and oppressed communities that also may predispose them to developing depression at some point in their lives. However, on an individual level, anyone can experience depression.
It takes more than education and awareness to get people the care they need. It also requires prioritization from lawmakers. At the time of recording, the federal legislature had not closed the 2018 funding gap for SANI's health clinic, which relies heavily on federal funding. SANI's health clinic serves 5 counties in the area, a population of more than 1.5 million. If the clinic closes, those low-income people won't have that federally funded care. SANI says calling your senators and representatives can help secure continued funding for clinics like hers. Okay, so we've talked about the healthcare utilization model that explains the process of how people recognize their mental health issues and decide to seek treatment. We've talked about the role of social support in sticking with treatment. We've talked about how income and other factors like incarceration and even social identity can be correlated with depression. We've talked about the importance of education, awareness, and action in keeping treatment options available for low-income patients. All of those things are happening now and have been true for a long time. But this is Health Further. What's next? What's the future of depression and mental health in a social context? We're not policymakers here at Health Further, nor are we lobbyists. We don't have a specific plan of action to promote, but we agree with the recommendations that the World Health Organization made in its 2014 report titled Social Determinants of Mental Health. Our global society requires interventions on the community level and on the national level. These include structural as well as environmental interventions to prevent mental health issues among all kinds of people. Probably the easiest action step every listener can take is working to destigmatize the disease. This starts with everyday conversations. It starts with sending this episode series to a friend. Raising awareness helps break down misunderstanding and helps reduce avoidable misery. There are reasons to be optimistic that the stigma is fading. The medical sociologist Bernice Pesco-Solito expressed hope in the U.S.'s new cultural openness to mental health topics. In particular, Lucero Cifuentes' brother Oscar says that social media is helping people share their mental health stories with a reach that would never have been possible 10 years ago. Meanwhile, Lucero Cifuentes thinks that more education about mental health would have a ripple effect on the way depression is understood by people more broadly in our society. Social worker Hannah Sani echoed that sentiment.
Knowledge is power, and empowering, and understanding what's going on can be really helpful.
So what can you do? If you're experiencing depressive symptoms, seek treatment. If you know someone who exhibits depressive symptoms, offer to set up a doctor appointment or therapy appointment for them. Be prepared for rejection or a harsh backlash, and stick by their side nonetheless, knowing that the disease makes them isolate themselves. If you or someone you know is experiencing suicidal thoughts, call a suicide hotline. Whether or not you know anyone experiencing depression, share the episodes in this series with your friends and get in touch with us to let us know what you think. We hope these episodes are sparking important conversations that will result in improvements to our health system, and we hope that starts with you. Now, a sneak preview of our next episode.
And when people do lose working time because of mental health problems, they are out for longer and generate more costs than for most physical health problems. So I think it's tremendously important and not understood just how prevalent these problems are and how much they're costing society, not just individuals.
Contributing Factors is hosted and produced by me, Caroline Leland. Our executive producer is David Schifrin. The series' original theme music is written and performed by Matt Phillips. The track can be heard on his upcoming album, so be sure to check him out at ilikemattphillips.com. That's Matt with two T's and Phillips with two L's. Stephanie Edwards is our music supervisor. Matt Faulkner leads marketing, and additional creative assistance is provided by Michaela Powell. Special thanks to Lucero Cifuentes for allowing us to share her story. And many thanks also to Rosa Cifuentes, Oscar Cifuentes, Bernice Pescoslito, Mary Carter, Hannah Sani, and Vicky Stocking. Contributing Factors is a Health Further production. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and Google Play. For bonus content from this episode, including the full interviews with everyone you heard today, go to healthfurther.com/contributing-factors. And while you're there, you can learn more about Health Further and everything we have going on. You can also find us on Twitter at Health Further. Please take a minute to rate and review Contributing Factors on Apple Podcasts. And then share it with your community. Your participation and support is what makes this show succeed, so thank you for being here and for helping spread the word. Join us next week as we discuss the policy and economics of our healthcare system as a whole.